This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when there was a clear black agenda, when we could talk confidently about the state of black America, but not anymore, writes Eugene Robinson in his new book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. Desegregation, affirmative action, urban decay, the decimation of the working class, and waves of immigrants from Africa and the Caribbean are some of the reasons why instead of one black America, there are four increasingly distinct groups with their own mindsets, hopes, and fears. Robinson says there's the mainstream middle class, a large group of the abandoned poor, a small transcendent elite with enormous wealth, power, and influence, and two newly emergent groups, individuals of mixed-race heritage and communities of recent black immigrants. Eugene Robinson is a Washington Post columnist who won a Pulitzer for his commentary on the 2008 presidential campaign. He's also a news analyst for MSNBC. Eugene Robinson, welcome to Fresh Air. So, you know, in your book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America, you've divided black America into four separate categories. Just have a way of thinking of black America, not because everybody fits so neatly, but
right.
But anyways, so the two possible categories I could see you fitting into would be the mainstream middle class, or perhaps the transcendent elite, not that you have Oprah Winfrey kind of money or Barack Obama kind of power, but you are a Washington Post columnist and an MSNBC news analyst, so you do have a lot of sway and a lot of visibility.
Yeah, I would certainly put myself in one of those two categories. If you're just talking bank account, obviously I'm in the mainstream category. But, you know, I put other people in the book who had that sort of juice and influence. So I guess as long as I have these platforms that I have, and I blame it mostly on the platforms and not necessarily me, but I guess I probably would put myself in that category.
You grew up in South Carolina in a community that was very educated. You grew up like a few hundred feet from two African-American colleges. There were a lot of African-Americans with PhDs, a lot of African-Americans who were affiliated with colleges in one way or another. And where a lot of the white people in the town weren't nearly as educated.
That's correct. I grew up in what was kind of like a college town. Most of the adults I knew had advanced degrees. And white Orangeburg was basically an agricultural community. So I kind of grew up thinking that black folks had all this. They didn't necessarily have a lot of money, but they had a lot of sophistication. They traveled widely. They read books all the time. And white people had more money and power, but maybe not as much culture or learning. It was the impression that I got as a little kid.
Now, did that impression that you got as a little kid jive with what you were seeing in American popular culture? Although at the time, there were far fewer African Americans represented in American popular culture on TV or in the movies. But nevertheless, how did it jive with what you saw?
As you said, there wasn't all that much to see. I remember when I Spy with Bill Cosby as one of the two lead characters in a network series. This was revolutionary. I remember whenever Leslie Uggams would appear on Mitch Miller, we would all be called. Yes, I'm dating myself and maybe you too. We would all be called into the living room because Leslie Uggams was on, or if one of the jazz greats was on, Ed Sullivan, for example, Ella Fitzgerald or Sarah Vaughan. What we were able to see, we held on to, and it was so exciting to see African Americans, even in a very small way, kind of break into popular culture. And it was exciting that they were being seen by the rest of the country at the same time.
Now, you went to a school that was part of a series of schools built by a philanthropist at the turn of the 19th century. The Rosenwald schools. And I had never heard about this before, so I'd like you to tell the story of your school and how it fit into this chain or whatever of schools.
Right. I went to a school called Felton Training School. That was the name of the school at the time. It was on the campus of South Carolina State University. It was a a very simple kind of literally four-room schoolhouse, four big rooms, two grades per room. And there were four main teachers. But the schoolhouse itself was one of some thousands built throughout the South by a Chicago philanthropist named Julius Rosenwald. That's where most of the money came from. And he started doing this as a result of a meeting he had with Booker T. Washington, who had the idea that he could fund schoolhouse building projects in the South, and that this was a great vehicle for a kind of black uplift.
You grew up in a kind of African-American elite in a way. You know, you were in a small town, but it was your community was built around two colleges, and your family was connected to those colleges. You got a good education in a small school, but a good education. Mm-hmm. And yet you were growing up in the segregated Jim Crow South. So you were an elite, but you were also not part. You were not allowed into into mainstream America. So what was your sense then of where you and your family fit into America?
First of all, even as a kid, I think I was, and I think most of, if not all of my friends were acutely aware of the civil rights struggle and what was going on. And I think we really defined ourselves in terms of that struggle as participants, as soldiers in the struggle for freedom and equality. And there were, you know, pressing issues about the right to vote and about public accommodations. There were stores in Orangeburg that you couldn't go in the front door, you had to go in the back door. In 1968, when I was in high school in Orangeburg, there was an incident called the Orangeburg Massacre, in which three black students were killed by highway patrol, state troopers, at the culmination of a three-night demonstration that started as a protest over a segregated whites-only bowling alley in 1968. So the kind of reality of Jim Crow was a huge factor in forging really my sense of myself. At the same time, if I'm being honest, because it was essentially a college town, there was a certain intellectual arrogance that we all shared. And you know, when I go home to Orangeburg, or when I run into folks from Orangeburg, that I think, you know, we still share in a way.
What do you mean by intellectual arrogance? How would it express itself?
It was said at the time that Orangeburg was the town with the most black PhDs per capita of any town in America. I never tried to truth squad that, to be honest, Terry. So I don't know if that's true, but that was always what was said, and that I think gave those of us who came from that community just a sense of ourselves as special and as capable and as, you know, smart and kind of special. And that feeling of specialness really, in the context of Jim Crow at least, was a kind of armor, I think. It certainly helped me at Orangeburg High School. I didn't go in with any sort of feeling of, you know, gee, can I measure up here? It was like, you know, wait till they see this. You know, well, you know, I'm not taking any stuff from these people. And I had a geometry teacher who seemed to really resent the presence of black students. And so I resolved that I would never give her the satisfaction of grading me down one iota in geometry. So I would study geometry for hours every night. I'm not really good at math, and I don't really have a good spatial sense, but I got an A+ in geometry just because I wasn't going to give anybody the satisfaction of not giving me an A+ in geometry.
So being very caught up in the civil rights movement, when you went to college, and this would have been early 70s?
This was 1970.
Okay. So this is a period when the Black Panthers are active. There's still a very strong civil disobedience movement. So you've got, like, both ends there. You've got, you know, a much more like aggressive, angry movement and a much more, you know, Martin Luther King oriented movement. Where did you fit in, and how did your family feel about where you fit in to that?
That was kind of the period when I kind of didn't, in a way. I mean, I went to the University of Michigan in 1970, and everything was going on. My father had gone to school at Michigan. I remember he drove me up to school, and he's showing me around the campus, and you know, and this is this hall and this is that hall, and we went to the Michigan Union, this old Gothic kind of building in the middle of campus, and we're walking upstairs and look out the front window, and down in the plaza, you know, in front of the Union, radical lesbians are doing street theater, complete with fake blood and simulated copulation and everything. I thought my dad was going to have a heart attack, but I was thrilled. I was like, oh wow, actual lesbians! You know, I've read about them, and there were like actual Jewish people. I had met one in my life until then, and I was kind of very fascinated with the whole what was happening with young people at the time, and much less fascinated at the time with specific questions of race. And then I stumbled into the student newspaper. I had wanted to be an architect. I was a lousy architecture student, but I stumbled into the student newspaper, and that was love at first sight. And so kind of the combination of everything that was going on in Ann Arbor in 1970, plus this whole new way of looking at the world, this journalistic way of going up to people and asking them questions that were none of your business, and they would answer you, and you could write about it. You know, I found that a really interesting and satisfying way to experience the world, and thrilling in a way. And so that's kind of what I did in college.
So you grew up in an African American community, very college oriented, and then when you had children, you were bringing up your children in a predominantly white neighborhood, predominantly right. White middle class neighborhood. How did your sense of what it was, what it meant to be African American, compare to your father's?
Entirely different, and it's really, you know, if you look at those three generations, you just see how much things have changed. My father, as an infant, made the Great Migration. He was born in 1916 in rural Georgia. His family was kind of gradually making the trek north. There were six siblings, and everyone was born in a different city. As they made their way north, out of Georgia, they went someplace else, and then to Columbus, Ohio, and finally ended up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is where my dad grew up. And you know, he served in the segregated army in World War II, as did his brothers. He moved to the Jim Crow South to marry and be with my mother, whom he had met during the war years. So he grew up at a time when those basic fundamental civil rights battles were being fought. He was there in Orangeburg when there were NAACP meetings at our church, and Dr. King came to speak at our church, and it was a question of basic fundamental rights that were being denied, and that's kind of different from the way things were by the time I reached adulthood, when those sorts of fundamental rights were guaranteed, and totally different from the world in which my kids grew up. You know, one evening I will never forget was the election night in 2008 when I, from the MSNBC set, got to call my mom and dad. My dad was 92 at the time. He has since passed away. My mother at the time was 87, and I got to call them and tell them that they had lived to see the election of the first African-American president, and then spent several days thinking about that, the fact that a life had spanned such a period, thinking about the world in which into which my father was born and the world in which he died, two different worlds.
Do you think that President Obama's political opposition is using language or positions that are a reaction in one way or another to his being African-American?
I do think so. I see it in the emails that I get from critics, and fortunately, this is just a small portion of the email that I get. But I got to tell you, I get some flat out racist stuff of a kind that I don't think I've seen since the old Jim Crow days.
Really? Like, and what's the tone of it? I mean, what's it focused on?
Sometimes just flat-out racism. You know, the coloreds, you know, couldn't organize a two-car funeral, and then, a caricature of the president as a monkey, and, that sort of stuff. Again, that's not most of the email I get, and I get a lot of very reasoned fair, I think, conservative or progressive criticism of the president. But I get more of this really racist stuff than I thought I would get and than I've ever seen before. And I'm talking, I get a few of these things a week, and they're not all coming from the same person.
So what do you think it is that has empowered people to think it's okay to write emails to you like this and to express overt racism like this? I mean, there was a time not too long ago when even racists thought it was socially inappropriate to express it publicly or that there'd be too much criticism for them if they expressed it publicly. But now you're finding that it's okay in some circles to just let it rip.
Yeah, it's okay just to let it rip. And I think there are a number of different reactions that I think President Obama's election and inauguration have provoked. To some people, and I don't think there's a whole lot, but to some people, it provoked them to write me emails or comments on my column that essentially say, what more do you people want? You've got a black president. What more do you people want? That sort of thing, that sort of you people construction that that we used to hear and we haven't heard a lot of recently. And what I think it has done to some people is kind of stoke anxieties that are partly demographic about the fact that, in 30 years or so there won't be an ethnic or racial majority in this country. There won't be a white majority. Everybody will be a minority. Anxiety about the economy, and not just about the recession, but about the kind of structural economic problems and whether or not my kids are going to have more opportunities and better life than I have. And if they're in danger of not having more opportunity and a better life, well, who's to blame for that? And they look at President Obama. So that's why you can get a finding like a poll I saw a few months ago in which really a staggering number of Republicans, I don't think it was a majority, but it was a huge percentage, who really and I think honestly felt that President Obama's policies that somehow favored or were designed to favor African Americans, when in fact the White House has kind of gone out of its way to not propose policies that have that sort of overt goal, that speak specifically to African Americans, precisely, I think, because that's the sort of thing they'd be accused of. So I can't think of a single one that they've come forward with. And yet there's this sense out there. And I think it's I just think it has to do with these anxieties, and there's something about Obama's election that brings them out, and for some people, I think makes them more acute.
Well, Eugene Robinson, thanks so much for talking with us. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, Terry, it was great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Eugene Robinson is the author of the new book, Disintegration, The Splintering of Black America. He's a Washington Post columnist and an MSNBC news analyst. You can read an excerpt of his book on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, November 30th, was the birthday of Samuel Clemens, better known by his literary alias of Mark Twain. He was born in 1835 and died in 1910, 100 years ago, which makes it rather remarkable that this week Mark Twain has a new autobiography on the New York Times bestseller list, right alongside memoirs by George Bush, Keith Richards, and Baba Booey. Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, is the first of three volumes of a 500,000-word memoir written by Twain himself. He completed it in the last years of his life, but stipulated that the manuscript not be published for 100 years. Well, those 100 years are up, and the interest in Mark Twain remains so strong that a book originally scheduled to print 6,000 copies has become a literary sensation. These new autobiographies are published by the University of California Press at Berkeley and are edited and annotated by the Mark Twain Project at UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. Our guest is Bob Hurst, who for 30 years has served as general editor of the Mark Twain papers. Our own David Bianculli, a Twain enthusiast, spoke with Hurst.
Bob Hurst, welcome to Fresh Air.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with the most obvious question. Why has it taken 100 years for this autobiography of Mark Twain to be published, and what makes it different from the versions previously available over the years?
Well, to be honest, it really is not because he said it couldn't be published for 100 years. It's taken us really about two decades to figure out how to edit and publish the autobiography. As you know, the manuscript has been available to scholars and really anyone who came to the Mark Twain papers since, I'd say, 1962. And many, many, many scholars have read it and or used it, referred to it, quoted from it. But to them and to us, the editorial project, there was a lot of mystery about how the thing fit together. For the longest time, we thought that Mark Twain had left a series of drafts, that he had never completed it, and that we were going to basically be forced to publish it in some kind of arbitrary way, like everything chronologically. But in the last 3 years, the editors who I've worked with for 40 years figured out that he had finished it. He knew exactly what he wanted in it and exactly what he didn't want in it. That's very important. And how he wanted it ended and how he wanted it structured. So all of a sudden, out of what seemed a kind of chaos, mm-hmm. emerged what turns out to be Mark Twain's last major literary work.
Well, let's talk about what that structure is, because he's quoted as saying, I mean, the first time in history that the right plan has been hit upon. Mm-hmm. He's so proud mm-hmm. of how he did this. And also,
yes, he is.
Yeah, he said, I'm the only person who has ever found the right way to build an autobiography. So what right. was that way?
Well, the way is basically to dictate it, to have someone to take down exactly what he says and to talk about what interests him at the moment, to allow himself to change the subject as soon as his interest flags a little bit, and to talk about the thing that interests him then. And so, in fact, not in any way to give you a chronological account of his life. It does not begin November 30th, 1835, I was born, and so forth and so on. He does not want and has struggled really for 30 or 35 years to get away from the conventions of ordinary autobiography. So it's the randomness of this which is unique, at least as far as I know, and which is one of the things he's most proud of. Why? That's complicated. But I think it's partly that he senses that this is a way to be more honest than he could be if he had structured it in a kind of self-conscious way.
Well, one of the things that – if I may, one of the things that he yeah. – we can quote him from a 1906 passage where he mm-hmm. sort of explains it. And if I can ask you to read it, it's in Volume 1 on page 441, just a paragraph that describes the autobiography?
Sure. I intend that this autobiography shall become a model for all future autobiographies when it is published after my death. And I also intend that it shall be read and admired a good many centuries because of its form and method. A form and method whereby the past and the present are constantly brought face to face, resulting in contrasts which newly fire up the interest all along, like contact of flint with steel. Moreover, this autobiography of mine does not select from my life its showy episodes, but deals merely in the common experiences which go to make up the life of the average human being. And the narrative must interest the average human being, because these episodes are of a sort which he is familiar with in his own life, and in which he sees his own life reflected and set down in print. The usual conventional autobiographer seems to particularly hunt out those occasions in his career when he came into contact with celebrated persons, whereas his contacts with the uncelebrated were just as interesting to him and would be to his reader, and were vastly more numerous than his collisions with the famous.
And that paragraph itself was just dictated and not substantially rewritten?
Yes, absolutely dictated. I don't have the typescript literally in front of me, but I'll bet you anything there is hardly a mark on it.
Is this because he had been a public speaker, one of the first sort of stand-up comedian celebrities, that he was so comfortable writing on his feet?
Well, Dave, it's a good question. I don't think there's any question that lifetime hours of practice is a crucial matter here, and certainly speaking publicly as much as he did, not just on the lecture circuit, but as an after-dinner speaker. I mean, he's notoriously good at that. I think the fact is this is a real gift, and it's a gift that's quite unusual. I mean, most of us have a separate part of our brain that attends to writing and one that attends to speaking. In this case, they're the same place. I mean, he is able to speak in such a way that you couldn't tell that it wasn't written if you didn't know.
And yet, even though he says that, you know, he's going to spend as much time on the uncelebrated as the celebrated, the people who went through his life are fairly amazing. If I can get
yes,
you to read one more passage,
sure.
If that's okay. Page 465, he meets Helen Keller.
Yes,
when
right.
Helen Keller is 14 years old, her teacher, Annie Sullivan, is there.
I see it. He's out at Princeton. And as you say, Helen is really only 14. So she's not really famous at this point. He's going to go on to get support for her education and basically to be a kind of help to her throughout her life. The guests were brought one after another and introduced to her. As she shook hands with each, she took her hand away and laid her fingers lightly against Miss Sullivan's lips, who spoke against them the person's name. When a name was difficult, Miss Sullivan not only spoke it against Helen's fingers, but spelled it upon Helen's hand with her own fingers, stenographically, apparently, for the swiftness of the operation was suggestive of that. Mr. Howell seated himself by Helen on the sofa, and she put her fingers against his lips, and he told her a story of considerable length, and you could see each detail of it pass into her mind and strike fire there and throw the flash of it into her face. Then I told her a long story, which she interrupted all along and in the right places with cackles, chuckles, and carefree bursts of laughter. Then Miss Sullivan put one of Helen's hands against her lips and spoke against it the question, "What is Mr. Clemens distinguished for?" Helen answered in her crippled speech, "For his humor." I spoke up modestly and said, "And for his wisdom." Helen said the same words instantly, "And for his wisdom." I suppose it was a case of mental telegraphy, since there was no way for her to know what it was I had said.
I absolutely love that story. The first time,
isn't that stunning?
The first time you read that, what was your reaction?
Well, I don't know that I remember, Dave. I mean, I've been reading this for a long, long time. But I'll tell you what's more interesting is, what's my reaction? The 15th time I've read it, it is exactly the same. Is it utterly charming? Is it just utterly amazing that he has managed to put on paper this encounter? After all, it's a very unusual situation, right? He doesn't have a lot of experience communicating with someone who's blind and deaf and so forth, and yet he gets it perfectly. He gets it down here perfectly. And I think you can't but be moved by it. It's very tender, and it's really outside the kind of oh, the frame that I think we most often think of Mark Twain occupying, the sort of curmudgeon frame.
Mm-hmm.
Here he's quite tender. Here he's quite attentive and very fascinated by her and still able to kind of joke with her and to enjoy the encounter in a way which, all I can say is it hits me the same way every time. I love it.
As the general editor of the papers, nothing in here is new to you or has been for decades. But what do you think, even in Volume 1, is going to be most revelatory to the general public?
Well, first of all, I think that relatively few people have read the earlier editions of the autobiography, Payne, Devoto, and Niter. And if they have read them, they got, I think necessarily got, a distorted view of what the autobiography is like, because those editors very deliberately and self-consciously and publicly said that they didn't approve of the way Mark Twain had organized his autobiography, and they had better ways of organizing it, and that's what they did. They took the pieces and put them in the order that they thought was good. So I think for the first time, both people who have managed to read those earlier editions and people who have not will encounter Mark Twain in a kind of personal way that they won't have seen him in any of his literary works. This is like having a conversation with Mark Twain, of course, in which he does all the talking, but you supply the questions in a way, and it's a very intimate experience. I've seen it described as feeling like meeting Mark Twain for the first time. I think that's a sound insight. And I think you're going to be surprised to see how continuously charming and interesting and humorous he can be about just about anything.
Looking over all of the original manuscripts that you have at the Mark Twain Papers, you can tell when there's an awful lot of revision going on, when there's some sort of inspirational jag where there are virtually no changes for pages on end.
Correct.
What are some of the best finds in that regard?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, when the first half of the Huckleberry Finn manuscript showed up in 1991, that gave us a window into how Mark Twain revised Huckleberry Finn. Because what he does is to write the whole book out in longhand, in manuscript, as it were. And if you look at those manuscript pages, they have relatively few changes on them. Not a lot of cancellation and insertion or anything like that. Now, of course, there are always the possibility of his having thrown away pages that did have revision on him and just, you know, made a fair copy. But what we discovered was that he has this manuscript typed. In order to provide the printer with a very clear text to set the book from. And if we compare the manuscript with the book, we find out that 80% of the revision that he makes on this book takes place on this missing typescript. For instance, the chapter 19, which is the very, very famous and deservedly famous and heavily praised description of the sunrise on the Mississippi by Huck. We can show that the draft, that is to say, the handwritten part of that, is so very different from the published text that Mark Twain must have extensively revised it. And we can show also that the things which people have pointed to as being characteristic of this wonderfully inventive way of describing the sunrise all occurred on the typescript. They all occurred in revision. And that's amazing because we know that Mark Twain in general never revised books after he published them. You know, unlike Henry James or actually most authors, he does not take advantage of reprinting or the second edition or the third edition to go in and correct or adjust or in any way tinker with the text. He simply eschews that completely. It's part of, I think, his mindset. I'm on to the next thing. I'm not going to be caught in the eddies of what I've just done.
What do you make in 2010 of the continued furor over the use of the N-word in Huckleberry Finn?
Well, I'm afraid I have a kind of unpopular view of all this. I think the furor is just terribly mistaken. I think I understand why it exists, But what it's done, I'm afraid, is to prevent them from reading the book in which this word becomes an issue. Because the book is designed to heap ridicule on racism. It's designed to make fun of people like Pap Finn. It's designed to show that even Huck, who is a little racist, a little redneck, even Huck is unable fully to grasp what's going on, and also not to shed it. That is to say, even though he's friends with Jim and manages to act out of friendship for him, he never sheds the basic commitment to slavery and the notion of white supremacy and so forth and so on. Then Mark Twain goes to great lengths in the end of the book to show you that even though Huck has tried to save Jim and acted really only in Jim's interest, he has not changed his mindset about all this. And it seems to me that what's happened is that the only writer that I'm aware of in the 19th century America to devote his masterpiece to an attack on racism, not on slavery, on racism only. Slavery is dead. Slavery is at least legally dead. The only writer to devote his masterpiece to that has now, has been since the mid-60s accused of being a racist himself. There is, no support for that. He is as anti-racist as anybody you can find in the 19th century. He's very enlightened. And the book itself is an attack on, as I said, people like Pap Finn. So I think it's too bad that that happens. I can understand why some people simply, have a kind of gut reaction to it before they have a chance to read it or take it in.
I keep hearing, and you can document this for me, that letters written by Mark Twain are still being found.
Yes, that's correct, at a rate which is actually stunning. When I took this job in 1980, I think we were finding about one a week. Then it went up to two a week and has recently gone up to at least three a week. That means letters in all kinds of ways. I mean, original letters found in libraries that are finally getting around to cataloging their letters, people whose grandmother or grandfather knew Mark Twain and put the letter in a book on the library shelf and it falls out when they use the book. But in particular, recently, the effect of the web is stunning.
How so?
Libraries are now putting up their catalogs. So using various tools that have digitized newspapers, a remarkable number of letters from Mark Twain get published at the time, contemporarily. And because these things can be searched, I must have on my desk now at least 100 folders containing new letters that need to be processed, need to be dated, and to a certain extent identified in order to enter into the catalog. And I think that what's happening is that the simple fact that he wrote 50,000 letters in his lifetime is coming to bear on the reality. It's not uncommon to come across a letter that says, I've just written 35 letters today, and you go and look in your files and you have two of them. That tells you that he's not out there writing more letters. He did die in 1910. We're confident of that. But the letters themselves are kept by people because they're wonderful letters. They're often very funny. Now, what happens as a result of that is it's like I have a great big picture with little tiny dots in it. And those dots are the letters. And what you're doing as you find these letters and gradually bring them into consciousness is you're filling in a picture of him that you would never have in any other way. And I think the world should be happy, pleased that that's going on.
Well, Bob Hurst, thank you so much for being on Fresh Air.
Glad to do it.
Bob Hurst is the general editor of the Mark Twain Project at the University of California, Berkeley. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor David Bianculli. You can read an excerpt of Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1, on our website, freshair.npr.org. For 7 years, and in 75 separate interviews, author Laura Hillenbrand talked to the now 93-year-old Louis Zamperini about his extraordinary experiences during World War II. The interviews were always conducted long distance over the telephone, a fact Zamperini didn't think much about until he read an article about Hillenbrand. The article talked about her 2001 bestseller Seabiscuit and about the fact that Hillenbrand suffers from chronic fatigue syndrome, a condition so debilitating it's pretty much confined her for years to her row house in Washington, D.C. When Zamperini realized the effort it was taking for Hillenbrand to interview him, let alone write a book about him, he sent her one of his three Purple Hearts. Hillenbrand's book about Louis Zamperini is called Unbroken. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Laura Hillenbrand is shaping up to be the Woody Guthrie of contemporary narrative historians. It's not just that she has an affinity for singing the ballads of dark horses who, through tenacity, skill, and a lot of heart, turn themselves into folk legends. It's also that Hillenbrand has a gift for recovering the spirit of mid-20th century America. It's despair, sure, but also its humor and its graceful refusal to put on airs. Seabiscuit was an almost impossible act to follow. But as Hillenbrand says in the acknowledgments to her new book, Unbroken, she knew she had found her next subject when she spoke to a then octogenarian Louis Zamperini on the phone, and the wisecracking spirit of a bygone age came through loud and clear. "I'll be an easier subject than Seabiscuit," Zamperini told her, "because I can talk." He sure can and sure did in 7 years' worth of interviews with Hillenbrand. The tale Zamperini has to tell, augmented by mountains of diaries, letters, and official documents, is a stunner. In a nutshell, it goes like this. Zamperini was born in 1917, a son of working-class Italian immigrants who made a life for themselves in Torrance, California. Louis was a juvenile delinquent from the get-go, always stealing food from neighbors' houses and concocting homemade explosives. Louis's older brother saved him by forcing him to try out for track in high school. All those years of scampering from the cops turned out to be excellent training, and Louis eventually competed in the 1936 Olympics with Jesse Owens. Hitler even gave Louis a congratulatory nod. When World War II broke out, Louis joined the Air Corps as a lieutenant stationed in Hawaii, where he learned to operate the bomb sight on a B-24, an unwieldy plane known to flight crews as the Flying Coffin. His pilot, Russell Allen Phillips, known as Phil, was respected as a damn swell pilot by the other men, and Hillenbrand vividly describes a few knuckle-biting missions where Phil's skill nursed the injured bomber back to base, sans brakes or fuel. But Louis and Phil's luck ran out on Thursday, May 27, 1943, when on a rescue mission in the middle of the Pacific, an engine died, and their plane went down, killing all the crew on board but Louis, Phil, and the tail gunner, nicknamed Mac. For a record 47 days, the men floated on two, then one, rubber rafts. Sharks circled constantly, scraping their fins under the bottom of the rafts. Water came when it did from the skies. Food consisted of raw fish and a couple of unwary albatross that alighted on the rafts. They were strafed by a Japanese fighter and tossed around in a typhoon. The men lost half their body weight and drifted for some 2,000 miles on open water. Mac didn't make it. The other two men survived to become prisoners of the Japanese, subjected to starvation, torture, and slave labor. Because of his Olympic fame, Louis became the special target of a sadistic Japanese corporal who dedicated himself to shattering Louis' spirit. Hillenbrand writes here with authority and her distinctive sensual intensity. You smell the stink of the maggoty fish the prisoners of war were forced to eat. You feel the horror of the void on that raft. But Unbroken aims for something beyond vicarious secondhand suffering. Through the lens of Louis' story, Hillenbrand explores how people fight to preserve their essential selfhood, their dignity, in the most extreme circumstances. She describes how the prisoners of war fought back against their captors, stealing newspapers to find out war news, farting when they were forced to bow to the emperor. She gives ample space to the home front, too, the everyday courage of Louis's mother who refused to believe he was dead, his father and brother who schemed to buy a boat after the war and search every island in the Pacific until they found him. Louis Zamperini is still with us. He even ran with the torch at the Olympics in 1998 in Japan. He's lived on into an age where we're more skeptical about heroes. Inspiration is considered an attribute of middlebrow, popular literature, not the highbrow stuff. Maybe that's why, as I couldn't help but notice, the New York Times buried its review of Hillenbrand's moving and, yes, inspirational book deep in the middle of the Sunday Book Review. Don't let the cynics intimidate you. Louis's story and Hillenbrand's unforgettable new book deserve pride of place alongside the best works of literature that chart the complications and the hard-won triumphs of so-called ordinary Americans and their extraordinary time.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.